Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. Once again, it's great to have your company and also the company of my two co-hosts. It's that time of the month where we've got a property market update, but before we get into that, let's have a quick chat to Kate and Dave. Kate, how are things going in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, pretty good. We're getting a lot of phone calls from agents asking us if we're interested in stuff that's, you know, coming up for listing, but, you know, maybe they want to sell it prior. I think there's a little bit of a feeling on the ground that in the event that things change, they want to get some stock sold quickly. And it is interesting. You and I were just talking about this. I look at all of the leading indicators and I actually think that right now is a great buying opportunity because I don't think it will feel quite this easy to buy for the next, you know, year. I think that we've just got these short few months between, you know, a little bit of uncertainty around interest rate movement and also a federal election. So I'm seeing the typical market jitters that we see when change that we can't quite put our finger on is looming. So, yeah, for all the buyers out there, I think do your own research to determine where you think the market's going. But right now it feels pretty good for buyers. Not a buyer's market, just a softer seller's market.
Dave, how are you going?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks, Pete. The numbers suggest, particularly Melbourne and Sydney, are flatlining now. We've seen that coming for a period of time and talked about it and the deceleration of many of the markets, probably as early as the first or the early in the second quarter last year. So, but what that means is people are paying prices that are 15, 20, 25% above what they were, you know, 12 to 18 months ago. So, you know, it's worth remembering that. It's going to be interesting how the rest of the year plays out. We've now got the data for the first quarter, which we'll go through today. You know, it seems pretty certain there's going to be some rate increases in our future this year. So, and inflation still isn't under control. So it's going to be an interesting year.
Certainly is.
I was chatting to you just before we pressed record, and it's very different in your market than our market.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important for us to note for our listeners as well. You know, Dave and I have always Melbourne centric because this is where we live and it's where we work. And obviously Dave's got more exposure to other sites because brokers can lend all around the country, but you've described some market conditions and we'll talk about it soon, but you're bidding this weekend and your market's crazy.
I mean, you just can't buy. Here, it's a great time to sell. Like I've sold two properties myself in the last few months. But trying to buy anything that's reasonably priced and just be very confident that, you know, it won't be worth less next month or in 6 months' time is just too hard. But it goes in cycles, and we're going to talk a little bit about that today because I've done some research on how long it's taken property prices to double in the various capital cities. And things will calm down, of course. They can't stay like this forever. Like Brisbane, I think, has done 30% in the last year, which is quite phenomenal. They also had a phenomenal period earlier this century. Yeah, but you're just going to be patient. You know, investing in property is a long game. You know, you've got to be in it for 10 years, maybe more, to really take advantage of the upswing in particular of a property cycle. But we're going to get more into that today in our property market update. But just before we talk about the current property, I want to follow on from what I talked about last week, which was we talked about country towns and regional areas last week. And I found online there is the Karoonda East Murray Council. So that's a council in regional South Australia. They have a housing initiative. So what we talked a bit last week about, you know, the death of country towns. They're losing their sporting teams, churches are being sold off, schools are closing because population is declining. And so they're trying to reverse that in their own little way. I mean, local governments don't have deep pockets like the federal government, but their housing initiative, they are selling off council land at a discount to people who are willing to build within a year. Now, I've heard of these schemes overseas. I remember, I think it was a couple of months ago, you could buy an Italian villa for a dollar. I mean, it was run down and you had to spend a lot of money on it. But the idea was you could buy it for a euro or a dollar, providing you would fix it up and live in it. They did that, which was good, but they found it a bit of a barrier because it was hard to get trade. So now they're stepping it up.
Chestnut.
Rather than just selling their land at a discount, they're actually going to build houses. When I say houses, there's only three of them. I mean, it's a relatively small council, but they build them, and if that works, they build some more. And the idea is that, you know, you don't have to worry about finding a builder. The house is already there for you. And people might say, well, you know, where are the jobs? But you bring your own jobs with you. Like I think I said last week, you know, they don't have a plumber in the council area. Well, if a plumber goes there, there's plenty of work because I'm sure there's plumbing work that needs to be done in that area. So congratulations to the Corunda East Murray Council. Rather than waiting for federal government or even state government to come to the party, they're doing their own little bit to help increase their population.
Yeah, it's a great initiative. We love hearing from our listeners and we'd love to tackle more of your questions. So please, if you have any on your mind, no matter how great or small, send us a message. You can email us info@propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor or go to our website, Facebook page, or simply click on the link in your podcast app under the play button and fill out our online form.
All right, boys and girls, so let's talk about a market update, what's happened in the month of March. Do you want me to kick off with the research that I've done, seeing as table on the list here?
Yeah, we're all on the edge of our seats.
So I said last week that I would have a look at how long it's taken capital cities to double in price. There's a big range. Sydney, it took 8 years to double. Melbourne, 9 years. Brisbane and Adelaide, huge, almost 15 years. It took them to double. Perth, almost 17 years to double. Hobart, the winner, 7 years. Darwin, 17 years. And Canberra, just over 12. But then I looked at how long did it take to double the previous time. And I looked at data which started in 2002. So I'm only going back 20 years. Now, Sydney hasn't had that chance to double and double again. So they haven't had a chance to quadruple prices. But Melbourne has. So in the last 20 years, Melbourne property prices have at least quadrupled. Same with Brisbane. But the interesting point about Brisbane is property prices doubled from September 2002 to June 2007. That's less than 5 years. But it took them almost 15 years this time around. So even though we might say property prices double every 10 years, that's an average. Adelaide hasn't had the chance to double and double again. Neither has Perth. Hobart has. They've doubled and doubled again in 19 years, and Canberra has doubled and doubled again in 20 years. So half of our capital cities have been able to quadruple in price in the last 20 years, and I imagine that probably by the end of this year, a couple more cities will be able to hang their hat on the fact that property prices have doubled and doubled again in a 20 or 21-year period.
What I found really fascinating about this, Pete, was, you know, when you said Hobart's the winner, Hobart was the winner this time around.
Yes.
And some of these performances that we've talked about are so, not even cyclic, but unpredictable. We can see some cities have a really good run and then we can see that some are really static for a long time and nothing has changed. I remember when I first bought in Hobart and I timed it terribly and it had a fantastic run and then it did nothing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's funny when people say to Ian and I now, well done, you must be really happy with your properties in Hobart. We are now, but I still maintain if I'd bought something different with my sensibility hat on when I purchased one of those, it still would have outperformed.
So it was an overnight success. It took 15 years. Is that
right,
Kat? That's right.
Yeah, along those lines.
It is very interesting data. Property cycles certainly play a huge role in property prices. And every capital city is quite different. I remember when I first started teaching property, you know, and you listed the property prices, Hobart would always be at the bottom, you know, for years and years and years. But that is not the case anymore.
I remember years ago when we were looking at Hobart and I got stars in my eyes, and this is long before I was BA, I was in my 20s, and I'd say to Ian, what about Queenstown? What about Zeehan? And it was a bit like that movie,
Zeehan,
The Castle.
I remember that one.
And then, you know, cheap. It was like that guy in the castle always reading the Trading Post and telling his dad about, you know, jousting sticks. And Ian would roll his eyes at me. But you know what? If I'd bought a couple in Queenstown or Zeehan, I'd be doing all right.
We're all geniuses in hindsight. Yeah. All right. So let's get back into our monthly update. So let's have a look at the month of March. Dave, you want to kick us off with what's happened around the country during that period?
Yep, sure. So through the month of March, and we've ended the first quarter now, Brisbane and Adelaide continued to outperform. Brisbane had a 2% growth rate, but it'll be interesting to see the impact of the floods on Brisbane moving forward. Adelaide, 1.9%, still flying. Hobart, interestingly, might have finally succumbed to its ongoing rate of growth. So it dropped from 1.2% down to 0.3% for the month. So that's the largest change of any of the capital cities. Also, interestingly, Perth went from 0.3% to 1% growth in March. So maybe the borders finally opening is going to have an impact on
their
price.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, Dave. For sure. I think it's finally going to happen there.
For sure.
Combined regions continue to steam along with solid returns. So they had 1.7% growth. If we look over the quarter, really Brisbane 6.4%, Adelaide 5.7%, combined regions just above 5%. So those three are still tracking above 20% annualised growth based on the last quarter.
I've been getting smashed at auction in Geelong. Can't tell you how upsetting it is when you know, it's a lot of preparation anyway, but when you drive down to Geelong and you're all excited and you think you've got a good budget and it's just one regional city out of many, it's interesting. But I do want to talk about Hobart, Dave. You noted that correctly, and by anyone's measure, it would look like it's cooled. However, Hobart has such limited stock supply that we're looking at median prices here and price movement, and there aren't very many sales that we can track here. It hasn't had an abundance of sales, and I just wonder if there's a chance that some of the peakier price points haven't been sold and that data, in fact, isn't necessarily showing that prices have come off. Maybe just the magnitude of the sale price has, for whatever reason, been a coincidence that we've had smaller price points. Who knows? I think Hobart's probably the trickiest one out of all of these cities to really track because stock is so tight and numbers are so small.
Yeah, the population is so small. It's really a market within itself that almost has its own environment, doesn't it? So they did have a significantly large number of new listings. So that probably played a part in March. So they increased by 14.7% of new listings. So Canberra and Hobart were the highest when it came to new listings for March. So I'd say that played a role because definitely supply levels have correlated with capital growth outcomes again this month, and we're seeing that pretty consistently most months.
Yeah, totally agree. I think it'll be a good one for us to unpack that chart later on in this episode because listing activity, obviously it alters supply and demand, and that really changes up your opportunity as a buyer, and it can be fleeting.
Yeah. And, you know, if even we come back, I didn't provide any comments on the 20 years of data that the professor has unpacked for us. But you touched on medians before. And if you look at the median chart, and in particularly for houses, median values, Hobart way up there at 781,000 used to track along the bottom. You know, now you've got Perth right down at 559,000. Adelaide at 648, so that's still 130,000 below Hobart. Brisbane's 40,000 above Hobart. So it really does, if you look at that number, it really does say you would think there's a bit of room for movement upwards for Perth, wouldn't you, given how far below. And even Adelaide, as we're already seeing, Adelaide's a significant number below Hobart. So there's going to be value in there, but particularly you would think Perth historically based on where its median for houses is tracking at the moment.
Yeah, you would.
Dead right. Yeah. All right, so Dave, we talked about property prices. What about property rents?
Yeah, so rents continuing. So, you know, in terms of the graph, we're seeing sort of a slight uptick And, you know, for one of the first times in a long time, as I alluded to last month, we've actually had national rents, as actually happened in the March quarter, outgrowing house values. So that means for the first time in a long time, yields are starting to increase broadly across the country, and more so in, say, Melbourne and Sydney, who, you know, both had negative 0.1 and negative 0.2 capital growth, but rental income was well above that. So again, the story is vacancy rates continuing to drop to a fresh 16-year low.
That's so huge. And you've got, and now the international borders are open. That's going to make it even tighter again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I'm really, well, I'm partly delighted and partly horrified when I look at our rents chart. For the first time in a long time, you know, I'm looking at rents units across the board and then rents houses across the board. Now, for houses, no surprises, everything is trending positively. We knew that it has been for quite a while. We've had many months of everything doing okay. And Melbourne is trailing. We're at 4.9%, which means broadly 5% rental increase over the year is what Melburnian landlords can anticipate, and tenants for that matter. And the highest is Brisbane at 11.6, which is pretty horrifying. But then when we switch over to units and have a look here, this is a really interesting chart. The unit change in rents over the last 12 months is pretty consistent. It really only ranges from Perth at 5.7 all the way to Sydney at 8.3, and everything else is in between, which means that broadly speaking, you know, 6 to 8% rental growth for all units in capital cities is what we're seeing. Now, units have never really exhibited this kind of growth in recent years, and it does suggest that people have returned to units as tenants, and that could certainly be correlated with moving back into the capital city markets where units are in higher abundance. It's a really telling chart.
It certainly is, and again, with us opening the borders to international migration,
yeah,
they tend to live closer to the city. They're used to living in units and apartments. And we've really seen that. I mean, Sydney is now recording the strongest lift in unit rents, up at 8.3% over the last 12 months to March. And that was after a 7.2 peak to trough fall in rents. You know, that's 15% change. Similarly, Melbourne's up 6.9%, and Melbourne posted the biggest fall of 8.5%.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And it wasn't that long ago. Yeah. When we looked across the board, some of the inner city rents were dropping like 25%. When you segregated it by LGA, local government area, it was really tough for the inner stuff. And now you're looking at price increases. That's a very rapid turnaround.
Yeah. And I think if people go back and listen to some of our market updates around the middle of last year, I think we said we thought that was around the bottom for the unit market.
Yeah.
And that's proven to be the case.
So we mentioned before about listings, and they obviously play a big role in prices, because often people talk about the housing prices is the relationship between demand and supply, and people only consider supply as new houses coming on market. But what people tend to forget is new houses only bring about 2% of new stock onto the market. So if there's 100 houses in an area, next year you'll have 102. But what has a bigger impact is the number of houses for sale, because that can range anywhere from 3% of existing stock to 6% of existing stock. That's a telling story there. You look at that graph there, in particular total listings, and we are 30% below the five-year average. That's huge.
Yeah, it's really huge, and it particularly telling Brisbane and Adelaide. Again, no surprise, they're having the strongest capital growth outcomes because they remain more than 40% below the five-year average, which is massive.
And you also mentioned, Dave, combined regionals was doing well so far as property prices was concerned. Well, that's because, you know, there's 22% less properties for sale in a combined regional area. So, you know, it doesn't take a genius to work out why this is happening.
Yeah.
It does take a genius to work to try and forecast when it's going to happen.
And how long it's going to last.
You don't need to be that smart to work out why it's happening.
Yeah, I've looked at this and thought to myself, you know, we're seeing an annual change in total advertised supply in the positive. So Sydney is up 7.5%. We're up 5.5%. We've also got Darwin with 18.1%. There's a lot of stock there for Darwin right now compared to past months and years. But I think we've done remarkably well to flatline with an increase in supply and threats of interest rate increases and what's going on globally and a federal election. I'm really pleasantly surprised that we've kind of held up. We haven't seen an increase in values, as you've just mentioned, but we have been static. And I'm quite surprised because Sydney and Melbourne increases of that magnitude, big cities, we're talking about a lot of new properties listed.
Yeah.
Certainly big change. We're about to get on to the non-direct property related data. Is there anything else, Kate or Dave, you wanted to talk about before we start on what's happening in general economy and what's happening with consumers?
Yeah, a little bit, Pete. If we look at our listing charts for new listings and then total listings, we've consistently talked for quite a few months now in our market updates about new listings being higher in number than past years. And even at the moment, nationally, we've got more new listings right now than what we had in any other year in the past 5 years except 2018. But when we look at total listings, we're still quite underdone. However, we can see that's ticking up. That figure is a reasonably sharp increase across February and March, which means total listing numbers have grown in the last 2 months. And that could speak to people's feelings about making a purchase decision right now, or it could speak to the stock starting to stockpile rather than diminish.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Dave, consumer sentiment and one of the indicators is House Price Expectation Index. What can you tell us there?
I know you think I just can't sleep the night before this comes out each month. But this month has actually been some pretty interesting changes. So The House Price Index had one of its largest falls ever. So it dropped from 155.8 down to 139. Now, still historically, that's very high, but that is a massive drop. And some of the largest weakness was in New South Wales. So we're seeing that, I guess, that general sentiment across New South Wales and Sydney becoming more negative as it relates to property than probably most other capital cities. And you know, that isn't a surprise to us. And we know historically Sydney tends to have greater fluctuations as well in its medians than most of the other capital cities. So that was quite interesting. But again, as I've said, and we sort of tracked that index over 2 or 3 years, thanks to Anne-Marie, put that together. It's a lag. We know the market's already flattening. This is just starting to follow that. Whereas time to buy a dwelling index and history showed us, tends to be more of a forward indicator. Now, it's also actually dropped again down to 78.3. That is surprising. This is the lowest the index has been since February 2008 during the global financial crisis, and it's well below the levels seen in the 2017-18 when the housing markets were particularly weak, as we know, leading into the election off the back of the Banking Royal Commission. So it's probably not a good harbinger for what, you know, a number of people think or the general consensus is in terms of the time to buy a dwelling.
Some very interesting stats there. Yeah, in particular, time to buy dwellings dropped 32% in the last year. So yeah, we were more optimistic a year ago with an index of over 100, and now we're well below 100 at 78.3.
Yeah.
Yeah. And interesting, time to buy a major household item, that's still in positive territory, but we're seeing some real changes in the data there. It's currently sitting at 103.7, and March 2021 it was 123, and then, you know, March 2020 it was 111. So even when COVID hit, people were more prepared to buy a major household item. That says to me that they're thinking about battening down the hatch and saving, or tending towards that line of thinking. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I think property prices seemingly quite high, inflationary pressures building, so all the talk of cost of living leading into the election. People knowing rate rises are going to come, even though they haven't, but they have with fixed rates for 1 to 1.5%.
This is what I wanted to quickly chat about, Dave. Like, everyone's talking about when interest rates go up, it's going to bring the market down. But the reality is interest rates have already gone up, haven't they? People are paying higher interest, but it just hasn't hit the headlines.
They've gone up significantly, which we've kept talking about. And since June when I spoke, look, the rates are going to start going up definitely now, for, and there was various reasons for that. They've actually, like looking back to that episode, they've gone up about 1.5%.
That's phenomenal. But still the market is going up. Yeah.
3-year bond yield. And we've had the highest percentage of people on fixed rate loans than ever. So fixed rate loans increasing has had a bigger impact than it ever has before. It's not being talked about that much. I think we got up to around 30% of all loans on fixed rates.
Yeah.
When generally that sits like in single digit numbers. So
it was compelling for such a long time though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
They were incredibly low.
Yeah.
What would be really interesting with consumer sentiment, and I'd love Anne-Marie to dig up some charts for us, is if we can go maybe a decade back and in particular have a look at the rate of change of consumer sentiment leading into a federal election, just so that we can maybe circle in on that and ask if, I'm not suggesting it's artificial, but ask if that's a driver for people getting the jitters at the last minute. Because in my coalface, it absolutely is. And I can consistently map back to each federal election where we've had a bit of a rumble in the jungle and people choosing to do nothing, not everyone, but quite a few, leading into the election. It's usually in that final, 2 months or 6 weeks.
Yeah. So for all of those of you that are waiting for the interest rates to go up and the property market to go down, the reality is if you're on a variable rate, you are paying more today than you were a year ago. It's just that it hasn't hit the headlines because different banks are doing it at different times. But I can imagine when the Reserve Bank goes from, 0.1 to 0.25, oh, my God, all the doomsayers will be out and say that the sky is going to fall.
If you're taking out a fixed rate, you're paying more or refinancing onto a fixed rate. The variable rates have come down. So banks have actually reduced their variable rates. So
is that right? So you're paying, there's lower variable rates out now than there was a year ago.
Yeah. That's my finding too.
My goodness, me.
Yeah, it's still sharp.
They're really trying to compete on variable rates now because they've had to price in the extra cost on fixed rates.
Yeah.
Lender
margins. They're losing in one, they're trying to make up for in the other.
Yeah, and that's historically how it's been. The low variable rate has historically sat under, the 3-year fixed rate.
Yeah.
And that reversed.
That's a normal market. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a normal market. Yeah.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. All right, so we're talking about loans. We can break it up into investor loans, owner-occupier loans, and first-home buyers. Well, on this chart that you've got here, Dave, we can see first-home buyers hit a peak in March 2021, but that's no surprise because that's about when the first-home owner incentive as a result of COVID ended and they've been dropping away. But some interesting things have been happening since then over the last year.
Yeah, look, I mean, investor numbers have kept creeping up. And so they're 33%, owner-occupied 66%. But that's around the market.
Yeah, historical average. Yeah. Two-thirds, one-third. Yeah.
Two-thirds, one-thirds of all properties owned, sort of that mix. So it's about normal, to be honest. Mm-hmm. First-time buyers are about 22%. So they've been creeping backwards and that's what, hence, the governments are throwing a bit of money at first-time buyers, but that's generally what they do. One thing that was interesting is the fall in the amount of finance in February. So owner-occupiers fell for 3.7% by 3.7%, investors by 1.8%, and first-time buyers by 9.7%. So
could we apportion a short month to that? I know that it's like 9%. It's not
very
probably
point.
Could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
28 days.
That's the other thing that I take notice of when it comes to auctions. Did that particular month have 5 Saturdays in it?
You are spot on, Pete. February was light on for auctions. So right. There you go. Yeah.
Or was one of those Saturdays Easter Saturday? Or was it Christmas Day or something like
good
that?
Good pickup.
Yeah. We'll have to watch March to see if that was less money was borrowed because of the shorter month.
Probably. Yeah.
Those percentages pretty much would correlate with a couple less days, working days in the month.
That's right. I had a journalist ask me about first home buyers and how difficult it is for them. And I think we've got a lot of great initiatives and incentives that take away some of that difficulty. And I think being able to borrow with a 95% LVR is a huge win for a lot of people, whether it be with government support or paying LMI or having parents help with equity, whatever it might be. And they pointed to this chart and these figures and said, but, you know, the percentage of first home buyers has diminished. But we have to remember that the sheer number of people getting lending has grown. So the number of first home buyers might have stayed consistent over a 12-year period or over a two-year period. It's just that we have a lot more investors and people trading up or down, as in upgrading, downsizing, with material shortage and difficulties getting builders. A lot of people who might have chosen to renovate or extend are saying, stuff it, we'll sell and buy.
And I'll keep banging on about this. The hardest position to be in is to be trying to buy a property as a single person.
Yeah. Mm.
And so if you break down the first time buyers, what we really should be doing is figuring out how many couples versus single first time buyers. It's much harder if you're a single first time buyer, but if you're buying with someone else, it's not as hard.
Yeah. You know what? I've currently got 3 first home buyers that I'm working with, and all 3 of them are co-purchasing with parents.
Right.
And the idea is they're tenants in common. They've got a designated percentage ownership, and the parents' contribution is based on their share being an investment. Like, clearly they're probably helping out their child through the goodness of their heart, but they're putting their money into something and viewing it as an investment decision whilst they're giving their child an opportunity to have ownership in something that has great, you know, attributes that might be a long-term keeper as well. I think it's a really fascinating way of moving forward.
People who've been listening to the show for a while would know that that's what I did with one of my kids a few years ago, because the principle is, you know, 50% of something is better than 100% of nothing. And I know many parents will go guarantors and do other, there's other initiatives. But I think for them to get their hands dirty, so to speak, and have an understanding of what it's like to own property, even though it's only half the property, I think is a very good way for people to get into the market. Now, not everyone has parents that can do that, but, you know, maybe their siblings, friends, I don't know. You know, I think friends are friends and business associates are business associates. And generally, I think you should keep the two separate. But, yeah, I agree with you, David. It is much harder for somebody on a single income, especially with a lot less permanent work these days and more contract or casual work, to buy property than it is for a couple. Yeah. All right. So our last bit of big picture data is unemployment. Now, listeners might remember last month that I was gloating that Adelaide has the lowest unemployment rate. But I did say the numbers are volatile, and it was disappointing but not surprising that South Australia has the highest unemployment rate this month. And I did say the ABS really needs to look at their sampling methodology or the number of people that they sample, because the job market in South Australia is not that volatile. We can't be top of the pops one month and at the bottom of the table the next month. It's just not right. But
yeah,
it nationally, when we look at it nationally, it's pretty good. It's better than it was, you know, a year ago.
Your participation rate is pretty low. So I noticed that the two on the chart here are lagging in South Australia and Tasmania, and participation rate is particularly low for both.
Says something about the economy or the broadly. I mean, Tasmania's unemployment rate's very low, isn't it? So there's a lot of people who live there who don't want to work.
And the underemployment rate is particularly high for South Australia and for Tassie. And that's a problem. It's a problem with data, and it's a problem with how we like to look at unemployment. If people are underemployed, we're not solving that issue.
Yeah, which, although underemployment levels, just like unemployment, are actually pretty good across the country at the moment. So, you know, we've hit 4% now unemployment, which is, you know, as low as it's been for a long, long time.
And the budget forecast 3.75%, which is the lowest in a very long time. Yeah. Whether that comes to fruition or not, it's yet to be seen.
And that's when they expect, wage rises to increase at the level that they would like them to, which is the big thing they've been holding out for, to try and not increase interest rates until wage rises are really clearly happening and inflation is consistently in that 2-3% target range.
I was very pleased to read, I'm pretty sure it was the governor of the Reserve Bank who said, we will be raising our interest rates based on evidence, not on forecasts. I thought that was very astute, very good.
Was that a slap to the banking economists?
Well, they've copped a lot of slaps
they should.
first time, but so have the RBA, because it was one of the first times they'd ever forecast we won't increase interest rates until 2024. And so a lot of the economists have been slapping them for that forecast. So I think...
Well, let's see, though. We haven't had an increase yet.
Not yet.
But, it's looking pretty likely this year.
Before we head off to our gold nuggets, is there anything else, Kate, that you wanted to add, or Dave, that you wanted to add about what's happened in the property market or the economy in the last month, or what might happen this month?
I think it's a really difficult month, Pete. That's what I was going to say. We've got federal election jitters and a lot of hazy information still. And until people see certainty and an election date, I think that these few months aren't necessarily great data points.
It'd be interesting to see, but I'm not as sure about the election playing such a big role, but I do think people are quite concerned about the prospect of increased interest rates, higher inflation and cost of living, and the war in Ukraine. I think those things are having
significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the cost of property, you know, at the moment, based on the last 12 to 18 months of growth, people think it's pretty heady generally.
Yeah.
Certainly is. All right, listeners, please don't go away. We've got Kate and Dave's gold nuggets coming right up.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
My gold nugget is for people to keep a really keen eye on stock levels, because we talk about supply and demand. It's not the only driver, but it's an important one. And what we can see is we've been in a little bit of a sweet spot for vendors jumping into the market, particularly in the big two capitals, Melbourne and Sydney. A lot of vendors jumped in because they felt confident about getting record prices. Now, vendors tend to follow what's going on in the market, and they're usually lagging behind a little bit because reality can take a little bit longer to sink in. But if we do see our market continuing to be static and, you know, flatlining, as Dave said, we can expect that the greedy, opportunistic vendors won't be listing their properties. So my prediction is that I think we'll see less listings, and then we'll have that exacerbated by a winter market. And typically Melbourne and Sydney don't have strong winter markets because it's cold and people don't tend to list like they do in spring and autumn. And that may well push prices up during this period. So I think buyers just need to look at supply and demand and ask themselves seriously, when can I borrow? When can I buy? What am I looking to buy? And is now actually a great time for me to jump in?
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Kate. Dave, what's your gold nugget?
That was a good one, Case. So 9th of June was when I spoke about fixed rates on the way up last year in that market update. So at that point in time, the three-year bond yield was 0.27. It's now, as of the 4th of April, 2.373.
Yeah, so that's big increase.
Yeah, above 2%. And one of the other key metrics that drive interest rates for lending is the bank bill swap rate. It was 0.29 and now it's 2.58. So they've both actually risen more than 2% in those last 10 months.
Very short space of time.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Kate and Dave. Another very insightful episode there. And hopefully our listeners have picked up a few tips of, you know, what's happening in the market and why it's happening. For those of you that are listening to this episode, as soon as it comes out, Easter's just around the corner. So we wish you a very happy and safe Easter, especially on the roads. Please take it easy on the roads. Don't eat too many chocolate Easter eggs. And we look forward to your company next week. Bye for now.
Thank you, everyone.
Have a great Easter, everybody.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about some of the themes discussed, take a listen to episode 12, Property Cycle Management, why now is always the best time to buy if it suits your personal economy and you have a long-term property plan. Episode 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. Episode 52, Dissecting 10 Years of CoreLogic Data, Capital Cities and Regional Areas. And also episode 95, Security Guarantees, Co-Borrowing, Gifts and More. Helping your kids buy their first property.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.